Good evening, everyone, and welcome to October 4th regular meeting of the Morro Bay Planning Commission. For those of you that are watching on Channel 20 tonight, we recognize you're probably just avoiding the vice presidential debate, but we're glad to have you anyway. we'll begin our meeting as usual with a moment of silence, please. Thank you very much. I will note that all members, four of the five members are present. We do have a quorum and call the meeting to order. And if you'd please rise and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, this is a time in the meeting that's set aside for Planning Commissioner announcements. Are there any announcements this evening? Okay, seeing none, I will just announce that Sunday after next, the 15th, is San Luis Obispo Airport Day. So those of you who have an interest in that, come on out. It's a lot of interesting exhibits and airplane rides for the kids, and should be a fun day. 10 to 3 at the airport. So then we will move on to our consent calendar. The consent calendar this evening. We'll move on to our public comment period. This is a period of for any members of the audience who would like to come forward and speak to the commission on matters which are not on the agenda tonight. Please come to the podium, give us your name, and we'd be very interested to hear from you.
Good evening, commissioners, staff. My name is Robert Krause. I'm an 18-year resident of Morro Bay. I've sent you, you probably recognize the name. I have CC'd some information and emails to you regarding our situation at our residence. And I was hoping that while the commission is in the process of reviewing and updating the Morro Bay City Ordinance, what I would like to do is to see the commission and to ask the Morro Bay planning staff to modify the current wording in Chapter 17, Section 1748-340 of the Morro Bay Code regarding satellite dish antennas to include UHF and VHF antennas. I have been talking with some of the staff members regarding this code, and it has been explained to me that this section only applies to satellite antennas. When I read the code, I believe the intent is to include all antennas that transmit, receive a broadcast signal. Let me point out the portion of the code that is the source of my confusion. At the very beginning, it says that the purpose of this section is to establish regulations to allow for the reasonable use of devices, so that's more than one, designed for over-the-air reception of transmission television broadcast signals. I'll stop with that. Herein lies the confliction. It is the intent of the current Morro Bay ordinance is to, quote, locate antennas and equipment where they are the least visible from public right-of-way and not to burden adjacent neighbors with adverse visual impact, why wouldn't Morro Bay Muni Code want to include UHF, VHF in this section? After all, this is just another projection that can be erected on a resident's property that can be as high as the zoning district will allow. Doesn't it stand to reason that antenna placement and height should be controlled and not allowed to be manipulated by some Morro Bay residents as a tool to intentionally disrupt the enjoyment of the neighboring property? That is exactly how the owners of 416 Kern Avenue are using their antenna. They have placed it in their rear yard fence line, on the fence line, strategically between our house and the view of the harbor. Their antenna is 25 feet high, 80 feet from their house, not connected, projects through the center of their bushes and positioned in a way to do the most harm. Approximately 8 feet from next to their UHF, VHF antenna, our neighbor has elected to erect a 25-foot flagpole, positioned once again behind their two storage sheds and between our house and the view of the bay and the iconic Morro Rock. It's nearly impossible for them to fly a flag on this pole because the flag continually gets caught on the bushes that it protrudes through. And I included some photos of that. Being a Vietnam vet who appreciates those who honor and serve our country, I don't have any objection with any person flying the national, state, or local flag, unless it is being used as a weapon to disrupt the enjoyment of the neighboring property. Because our neighbor is having such a difficulty flying the national flag, they fly a windsock now. The residents of 416 Kern live on a 52 by 150 foot deep lot. And for spiteful, vindictive, and retaliatory reasons, they have decided to erect whatever they can with the intent of disrupting the enjoyment of our property. I would like the city to adopt a flagpole ordinance that would limit the height of a flagpole to no higher than 15 feet in a residential district. I also believe that anyone erecting a flagpole or antenna should be required to get a no-cost permit from the city that requires them to have the approval of their immediate neighbors and a planner, a city planner. I hope the Planning Commission will review these two issues as a future agenda item and direct Morro Bay Planning Department to modify their code so all citizens of Morro Bay are protected from individuals who intentionally hurt or who are just plain inconsiderate of their neighbors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Krause. Anyone else? Seeing none then, we will bring it back to the commission. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah.
I have a question. This is actually for Scott. The title of the city ordinance, notwithstanding satellite dish antennas, I read here, devices designed for the over-the-air reception of television broadcast signals. I don't profess to be an expert, but doesn't that include UHF and VHF?
It does. The unfortunate part of the ordinance is that's sort of the purpose statement to the ordinance, the preamble, and it tells you those are the things that we're going to try to regulate too, and then you go to the subsections below it, A, B, C. A, in this case, is the only thing that applies to residential neighborhoods, and it goes A1, talks about a satellite dish antenna, it goes A2, talks about a satellite dish antenna, it goes A3, talks about things in the R3 and R4 district. A4 is the only thing that you could probably say that applies to it, and all it deals with is the wiring. I've had several conversations via email with Mr. Krause, and I certainly appreciate his frustration when you read the opening statement and then you actually look what the regulations are, meaning the things that we can enforce doesn't provide much help. So his point is actually fairly well taken and identifies a hole in our ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My opinion.
Can I have value for
Scott, when I read this, you know, when you look at the spirit of the law, isn't UHF and VHF regulated by FCC regulations?
Correct.
Okay, so I guess maybe later on we could, when we go through future agenda, maybe have a discussion. I think it's valid to have a discussion on this. Maybe we can do that, like at the end of the meeting when we have future agendas. Is that possible?
Sure. I mean, you guys can certainly discuss that.
Okay.
Yeah. I suppose it could be, I haven't read through the full text of this section. I don't know, it might be open to a resolution of interpretation. if we decided to amend it, that would have to go through Coastal Commission, right?
The way that it's written, it would have to be amended to apply. I mean, straight up, the beginning piece of the sentence, when it says satellite dish, you can't apply it to anything else. It's, you know, I mean, it's basic structure of how ordinances are written. So it's, I mean, it's problematic. I mean, you want it, you read the beginning and you think it should apply, but it doesn't, because when you get into the actual regulations, it talks about it only applying to satellite dishes. The city, I think, at some point, you know, picked this back up and looked at it again, and then we came up with an ordinance, but it was out of compliance with federal regulations, and so, because they had changed again, and so they didn't make it through Coastal Commission. Does that sound right? No, we never took it there. Okay, we were sort of marinating on it, and there was some inconsistencies with federal law, so that we had to fix, and so that is one of the things we're looking to bring back as part of the zoning code update.
Yeah. Well, I think there might be a couple of other. I don't want to get too far into discussing this because it's not on the agenda, but we can talk about agendizing it later on. There might be some other angles. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Then moving on to the consent calendar. The consent calendar today consists of item A1, the current advanced planning and processing list. Are there any questions on that, or concerns or observations? If not, then do we have a motion to accept the consent calendar?
I move that we accept the consent calendar as written.
I will second that.
We have a motion. We have a second. Any discussion on the motion? If not, all all in favor signify by saying aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries 5-0. So then moving on to public hearings. Our first public hearing item this evening is a continued item from a couple meetings ago, I think. Case number CP0-500 and UP0-440, considering a demolition proposal at 3300 Panorama Drive, Morro Bay. We have a staff recommendation for continuance. Would you like to comment on that, Joan?
Or Whitney.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the other Joan.
Thank you, briefly. As you mentioned, your commission looked at this tank demolition project at 3300 Panorama on the 6th of September and continued the hearing until tonight. In the meantime, the applicants had requested a continuance to a date in the middle of November to allow time for a neighborhood meeting so the applicants and neighbors could get together, go over concerns, answer questions about project specifics that some of which came up during the September hearing. That date, as you know, is not available for a Planning Commission hearing, and so staff is recommending this evening that since this was continued as a public hearing item, that your commission hear public testimony on the project and then continue the public hearing until December the 6th to allow for a full review on that date. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have ex parte communications to discuss on this item? If not, then we will open it up for public comment. Anyone who would like to speak on this item, please come forward and do so.
My name is Ed Griggs. I live at 539 Whidbey Street in Morro Bay. On Saturday, October 1st, many of us received a letter from Steve Gallegos, Tank Removal Project representative, outlining an informal meeting at 3:30 Panorama. We categorically reject this venue. I asked Scott Graham at the September 26th City Council meeting to try to arrange the meeting between the applicant, Chris Matthews, and our neighborhood to be at a neutral venue rather than at the tank removal site. I also asked the mayor, Jamie Irons, to help facilitate the meeting off-site. Kristen Hedlund sent a letter to Scott Graham on the 26th of September stating that we need a meeting off-site. The next day, a notice was posted at 3300 Panorama stating that the October 17th meeting would be held on the site. The Steve Gallegos letter stated that the 4 p.m., the meeting at a 4 p.m. walk around the site, and an informational meeting at 5 p.m. That is not what we asked for. Several of us asked for the meeting to be off-site. It needs to be at a venue where he has no authority to control the contents and speakers of the meeting. The proposed meeting starts at 4 o'clock. This meeting time is inconvenient for working people. This precludes a great many of the people in our neighborhood. The letter says nothing about the applicant, Chris Matthews, attending the meeting. It was our understanding that he would be attending. If he wants to clear the presently foul air between the neighbors, the applicant needs to be present. When the meeting does take place, we would like to know who is presenting material at this meeting and what their titles are. Once again, the City of Morro Bay staff have failed to attend to our request to have the meeting at a time and place convenient for us neighbors, attended by the applicant. I recommend mounting another letter writing campaign addressed to the City of Morro Bay Director of Development, copied to all concerned. We have several alternatives to the 330 Panorama venue, including the City Library and the Morro Bay Community Center and the Vets Hall. Attached, please find the documented letter requesting an alternative site and the associated documents. We need a response ASAP so we can book an alternative site. The feeling that I'm getting right now is that us neighbors can do anything and everything that we want, but the city, specifically the development director, is going to force us to accept the entire proposal sent by Chris Matthews and that we're to trust them. I just would like to remind you that the City of Morro Bay could have acquired this property for $1. And they dropped the ball. So we have no confidence in the city representing our needs. And we certainly don't expect the applicant to respect our needs in the community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who would like to speak at this point? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the commission for discussion. Okay, and
I was just trying to be polite. I know some other people have got notes. I've written my comments, so I don't. Okay, I'm sorry. It's Robert Walker, 523 Whidbey Street. That's right across in full view of the project. I have my comments written down. Would it be appropriate to hand them out, or?
Thank you.
As time's gone on, let me just read this first. As we've accumulated more information and after looking into the project, we have come to the appreciation, first of all, of the scope and the complexity. It's not an easy job. It seems that there are some real unknowns concerning the possibility of environmental hazards that the residents in the vicinity of the project could be exposed to. Carol and I simply don't understand why an EIR wasn't required. I know that staff has talked about it, but I hear a lot of jargon that it's not part of my vocabulary. The applicant introduced this term of a hygienist, somehow or other somebody tagged on environmental hygienist. The applicant says he will hire an environmental hygienist to make sure the work on the tank removal meets the mitigation requirements. It seems to us the environmental hygienist should be an independent from the applicant. The person who fills this position of environmental hygienist should be vetted by the city, paid by the city, reimbursed by the applicant. Performance bond. Do we really know that the applicant has sufficient funds to complete this project if the project costs exceed the original cost estimates because of environmental issues that might come up? A performance bond would protect the city and the residents. I know that there was a discussion about this in the last meeting and stuff, but I'm kind of coming at this with more information than the last time around. Tree replacement, small item, but it was in my last comments. I think it didn't get the consideration that I believe it really deserves. We commented on this in the previous testimony. My apologies for repeating myself, but I don't believe that it was given the attention it requires. Mitigation says replacement in kind. We need a full definition of what replacement in kind is. The trees being removed are over 20 years old. You know, you can't put a bunch of 5-gallon trees out there and expect anything to happen. The trees, irrigation is mentioned, but the duration of irrigation is not defined. In a drought period, you could irrigate them for a year and they won't survive. As a side story, I have a colleague who lives in a different community required to put in a street tree, and he did. Guess what? He never watered it because he didn't like where it was required. So they could put the trees out there, and if we don't define what the irrigation requirements are, their survival rate isn't going to be there. So that's the end of my written comments. I have one other issue, and that is there is developing a mistrust, and it's going to be difficult for anybody to do a good job. I believe the project needs to be done, but it needs to be done correctly. And our house faces right there, so if anything goes wrong, we're like one of the first ones to be affected. So we want the project, we just simply want it done correctly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, my name is Kristen Hedlund. I live at 498 Yerba Buena Street. I've been a resident here for 25 years. I actually was coming here to speak during public notice in the beginning because I actually never received a second card, and I don't know why I didn't. I live 18 feet from the property, but I never got the second notice. I wanted to thank the planning department for postponing the decision and setting a new agenda so that we have all of the city attorney and so on present so that we can discuss this at complete length. I feel that the planning department has given the developer a light touch, and I ask that you protect the soil, the air, the sensitive habitat, the street, the sewers. And for me, I think about what's going to happen with phase two of the project, and I think that we should have an idea what's going to happen. I think that there should be a bond. I'm not even prepared to speak because I thought I was just going to come up here and say a little quick thing, and then I was going to speak next time on all the issues. I'm really disappointed I didn't get one of these. I'm kind of confused as to what to say, but I look forward to the meeting on December 6th. Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Annie Pavarsky. I live at 515 Yerba Buena Street. At the meeting on September 6th, Chris Matthews, applicant agent, stated that the herd of goats that had been grazing on the property for the last 3 years, quote unquote, are gone. This following both public and planning commissioners' comments about the goats. Save two goats, a male and a young female left to breed, they are indeed gone. A number of them were poisoned and died. I've created a timeline events that transpired following the last meeting and will send it to all of you as it is longer than the 3 minutes allowed. I also want to say that along with Bob Walker, I'm not opposed to the tanks coming down, with the caveat that the integrity of the various owners and agents listed as Ryan LP, Moro 94 LLC, CVI Group LLC, Chris Matthews of Oro Financial of California have raised my level of alarm about the project to a higher level of scrutiny. Thank you.
Good evening, Terry Waller, 465 Sicily Street. I share many of these concerns, and I'd like to start out by agreeing that a performance bond to make sure this project gets completed would be a really good idea, considering that these companies are protected by their LLC status, and this is a huge project, and there's various things that could come up along the way that are not anticipated. I also have concerns about this project growing or the work exceeding the project description that's before us, before the Planning Commission. So this is a tank removal project, removing the pipes and so forth, and removal of some of the concrete. I'd be really concerned about extensive and complete removal of all the concrete on this property, because that's additional air quality issues would be raised. There's additional truck traffic. There's additional noise, and certainly a lot longer construction period. So I think the conditions of approval that go before you should make it really explicit what the project description is and what the containment, essentially what they're allowed to do and where that project stops, and then the next project goes forward. And I think the next project could well be excavation and removal of contaminated soil. We just don't know the full picture yet. It's sort of like archaeology, where you start digging and you find perhaps more or perhaps nothing in terms of archaeological resources. Same thing with the contaminated soil. You know, maybe let's hope that there isn't much, but there may be. And that, again, would be a whole nother series of, you know, grading, excavation, evaluation by different agencies, the Environmental Health Department. I think Regional Water Quality Control Board's involved also, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a lot of oversight, but also this project is pretty, has the potential to be really extensive and drag out for a really long time. I'd be really curious to know what we do if the project isn't complete in the 2 months that's anticipated, and kind of where that would go from there. But it seems to me like very likely they will need to do another environmental document, and they'll need to possibly apply for another conditional use permit for grading, excavation, remediation work beyond what they intend to do. Having said all that, I'm actually in support of having the tanks removed at some point. I think eventually they're going to rust out and become a hazard. I don't know how far along that rusting process is, but I think it's a good thing to remove the tanks. It's just a matter of doing it in the right way. But again, I'd like to emphasize the need for a performance bond, because it's a real big project, and it'd really be a good idea to have it finished on schedule. So thank you.
Thank you.
I have written up everything that I said, and I'd like to leave that to you, please. I only have one problem there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I will.
Hi, I'm Jerry Lane. Excuse me, I live at 404 Whidbey. In addition to the concerns expressed so far, I have one additional, and it's the traffic. That neighborhood is already an issue at Yerba Buena and Highway 101. That's a serious issue if you've ever been up there. So I think there need to be designated routes, if that's possible, and they need to be enforced. Because the traffic, we will have some accidents and some, I believe, and some serious issues with traffic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Anyone else? Okay. Last chance. Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the commission. What we have before us is a request for, would anyone like to comment, or are there any questions regarding issues that were brought up during public comment?
Go ahead.
I was just wondering if, can we go over again the chain of logic as to why an EIR wasn't required?
So, if I leave anything out, Whitney, please chime in. What you're looking at is preparing all the pre-environmental work to address all the concerns that come out. If we do that and we have mitigation that adequately mitigates the project, there's no reason to do an EIR. Typically, what you're looking at, you'd want to come forward and say, hey, you haven't done X, Y, or Z, or we're unable to do that, especially if we were able, if we weren't able to mitigate something. You'd have to go through an EIR process for this, and the city would have to adopt a statement of overriding consideration for something that was unmitigable, or at least something that couldn't be mitigated to less than significant. As it stands right now, we don't have any of those things in the current environmental document, so we went through the mitigated negative declaration process. Certainly if, as we have these conversations with the public, as we have the conversations through public hearings with the Planning Commission, as they bring up additional information as part of the neighborhood workshop that the applicant's putting on, certainly additional information could come out, and maybe that additional information identifies things that aren't adequately addressed, and we'd have to look at seeing what that would look like. Again, it's all a process, but in looking at all of the issues that were out there, it seemed like demolition of tanks is something that happens fairly regularly, and there's a set amount of things that usually go along with those, and we sort of know what those are to some extent, and we have a lot of overriding regulations and different local and state agencies that are involved with the process, and there's a lot of oversight, and we sort of, because they were responsible agencies, they give us comments on the MND, and so that all gets wrapped into the conditions that go along with the project. So.
As I said before, I worked on military facilities, and there is material that isn't really used normally in the public sector. My concern is when we had this presentation, the gentleman, Chris Mathis, he had a picture of him inside the tank. And this is kind of a reckless behavior, because you should have an OSHA confined space permit if you've been climbing in any kind of things like that. That's just wrong acting. And I feel that because of this kind of cavalier attitude, I think that the public is justified not having the any kind of meeting on property. If I went to a meeting, I wouldn't want my grandkid on there until we check things out. The guy that spoke about that he's going to be doing demolition, he wouldn't let his workers get hurt, that's fine, but you get paid hazmat duty when you work on this kind of stuff, so you know what you're getting into. What we're dealing with is a public issue, public thing here, and I think that the owner already has demonstrated not good judgment with regards to behavior. So I feel that I strongly suggest that maybe you can work with the people and maybe come up with a place where they can meet in more neutral terms.
So I brought this issue to the attention of the applicant, and the applicant said, I've been getting a lot of inquiries from folks that are interested in walking the site. That's why they want to have the meeting there. I mean, that's simply why it was conveyed. It's not a city meeting. The city, I mean, we're going to have a representative there, probably myself, but it's really for the applicant to talk to the public. I mean, the meetings where staff's present, we talk and we answer questions, that's here. That's why we have planning commission meetings. That's why we have the permits that go along with this and so forth. That's where we come into the game. I mean, this is really for engagement of the applicant with the public. So the public can, yeah. So anyway, that's, and so I've conveyed that concern to them, and they've, came back with the justification that several of the neighbors have provided that they would like to visit the site and be able to walk it to see what's going on there. And so I think that's a valid reason to have some sort of, meeting on the site. Whether they, have a separate one off-site or something, that's, again, not up to the city.
My point is that next time he climbs inside a confined space, tell him to get an OSHA permit, because that's a violation right there.
Let's see. With respect to the first speaker objecting to the meeting on site because of a fear that the applicant might control the discussion, strikes me as unlikely. But I certainly think that there might be some real utility for the members of the public to actually be there at the site and be able to see and point to some of their concerns and be able to physically see it. That doesn't mean that's the only meeting at which the concerned public would be there, because certainly being out by the tanks isn't conducive to discussion, probably, wind and being able to hear. So I would suggest that concerned people go to the site, see it, and then later in the day or at some other opportune time, they come together to have a discussion where applicant and neighbors can sit down and talk. With respect to some of these other issues, the environmental hygienists, I've mentioned this before at other hearings where I'm always skeptical when the person given responsibility for regulating is in the hire of the person being regulated, whether it's Wall Street or physical examinations, etc. So my sympathies are always with an independent contractor who can do some of this sort of investigation and regulating. The performance bond, that's an interesting idea. And I'm recalling the optimism of the applicant that he could do a relatively quick and safe an efficient job of this tank removal. And if that's the case, I don't think there would be any serious objection to a performance bond, because he's optimistic that things will go as planned. The tree replacement also, I remember reading that the applicant had up to 5 years in which to replace the trees. So I would hate to see at the end of a five-year period that we get a 2 or 3 or 5 gallon tree. We should have perhaps not as substantial as the trees that are going to be removed for good cause, but certainly more than just little straplings, whatever you call a young tree. This business of the There was some uncertainty at the close of the last meeting as to how many truckloads were to be likely. I think the applicant was talking 40 or 50, and then I was hearing, because of the need to remove the concrete, that there might be as many as 200 truckloads. Well, clearly, we have to get more information on that. And then that brings us to the issue of the wear and the tear on the street, and how do we demonstrate if the streets that were used for the transportation were damaged and to what extent they were damaged. So I'm really thinking that we should settle on one route to the site, and that will place a greater burden on the neighbors who are bordering that street, but it will also allow a much more efficient and accurate depiction of what the current state of the road is, and perhaps what the state of the road is halfway through the removal, and then what the state of the road is at the end. And it still leaves open what sort of guarantees, financial guarantees, the applicant has to present to assure us that he'll be able to repair any damage to the trucks.
Larry?
Since I missed the September meeting, I'm coming up to speed on this, but Scott, could you explain to me the attached liability and the veil of protection that the LLCs apply? So. Okay. They're seen as the development corporations or LLCs, and what liabilities are attached to them, per se, if there's contaminated soil underneath the tank where they haven't been able to core drill?
Yeah, they're going to be required to do additional testing. Nellis County Environmental Health has a pretty extensive list of additional testing that they need to do once they remove the tanks.
And even before they remove the tanks. And who holds the liability on additional remediation? Is it the Air Force, or is it the?
It's the owner of the property, which are the applicants.
And is that being able to be released in a bankruptcy, or is that still attached to the owners or the officers of the LLCs? How's that held?
That's a great question, and I will have an answer for you on December the 6th, if not sooner. I will address that in my staff report after I talk with the city attorney.
Okay, great. Thank
Otherwise,
you.
I'm practicing without a license.
Yeah. And another item that concerns me is I haven't heard mention of a preliminary site plan for the final work. It seems like as a developer, you would know pretty much what your final state's going to be, so you could do your financial projections. Have they presented a preliminary site plan for the project, so that we could review what is essential for their demolition, as opposed to, a blanket demolition? What could be maintained and what could be worked around?
You're talking about a site development plan, say a residential neighborhood plan or something like that?
Right.
No, we do not have an application for anything like that. The applicants and project owners haven't quite determined yet whether or not they would proceed and partner with someone to do a project like that, whether they would perform this demolition and offer the property for sale. So we do not, that information doesn't exist yet.
Could that be required at this point?
No. They're going to give us we have a site plan,
okay,
for it that's going to show what's being demoed and what's not. And so that's kind of the extent of it. I mean, it's a pretty typical demo plan. These things are being removed and they're required to stabilize soil after they removed things and those types of things. So
final state track map isn't required?
No, there's no requirement for that. We couldn't compel it if we wanted to.
Okay.
It's up to the applicant. I mean, they get to choose what they want to do. They get to choose whether they're going to sell it to someone. They get to choose whether they're going to develop it, and they haven't come forward to us with that information as of right now. We've had some it's like Dynegy. It's very preliminary conversation. They basically said they weren't sure what they were going to do exactly. And I think that maybe deals with who they engage later on down the road.
Okay.
If we did have something like that, then the environmental document would look different because we would have a future project. We don't have that right now. We don't have anything like that right now.
Okay. It seems like that might be, you know, pertinent to what the demo permit would allow. Would you see that it would change any if we had a preliminary track maps?
So you're asking, would we retain the tanks and the pipes and the pipelines? Well,
no, maybe not the tanks and the pipelines, but maybe some of the concrete might not, you know, might be in overburden, where they're doing some additional site work to build up the site that would cover the existing concrete rather than removing it. So if we knew what the final state of the project is, we would be better informed on what demolition is required and what could be maintained or retained.
I mean, so the basic answer to that is the final state of the project is the only project that we have in front of us, which is the demolition project. I mean, that's the only thing that we have to look at, and we have to make our decisions based on that.
Okay.
But it's not like we didn't ask. We did ask them when we walked the site with them, but that information was preliminary. They were very much sort of undecided at that point, it seemed to us. I mean, and they haven't come forward with any information since then that's really solidified that, and they're not required to.
Okay. Are we going to be CC'd on the meetings, the site meetings and stuff?
I can definitely ask that they do that, and then you and Scott can talk about Brown Act stuff, et cetera.
Good. Would we be in violation of Brown Act if we attend the meetings or just as listening?
Potentially, no. I'll probably verify with the city clerk and city attorney's office. I think what you'd be limited, to is, well, it could be two of you and then we have no problem. Or you can go and not speak.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'll be there to make sure you don't speak. I can certainly verify, that, and go from there. I
mean, okay.
So. I'll follow up with you on that.
Okay,
thank you, Commission.
Sure, of course.
I'm sorry, there was one thing I forgot to ask. I remember at the last meeting, the applicant relied, I thought, fairly heavily on this 1996 report from the Department of Defense that basically said that the site was safe. And I think I might have asked, or maybe I just thought I asked, but that declaration may have assumed that a tank or tanks intact were safe in terms of contamination, but the applicant was taking it beyond that to say, in fact, this site represents no known danger, and I wonder if you could really draw that inference from the 1996 report, which contemplated the tanks, frankly, sitting there, but probably not being taken apart.
You're basically correct. The site closure letters from the Department of Toxic Substances Control and the State Regional Water Quality Board noted that the site was safe to be closed and essentially abandoned, left in place as is, that it didn't pose any problems for, hazardous problems for people as it is. It also said that going forward, there should be a full environmental site assessment, not to be confused with a CEQA environmental review, to determine what further level of remediation needs to happen. Quite likely, there still are some hydrocarbons in the soil there, and quite likely, they would end up having to haul some of that away.
Real quick question. Is there sewer service on that property?
I believe so. There's water and sewer service as far as I know.
Okay.
So one other question. Why would we allow up to 5 years for tree replacement? What's the rationale behind that?
Okay, so maybe that was a bad idea. That really sort of had to do, that sort of follows from the notion that we don't have a future site development plan, that if they were to put something together or something came to us, that maybe we would want to see this tree replacement there on site, but not have it done so that when additional grading, et cetera, was needed, that it kind of took out the ones that had been planted. We talked at the last meeting about potentially doing on-site planting kind of out of the way in the ash buffer area so that they could remain. I think the tree issue is probably the least of our big issues right now. We can certainly condition regarding irrigation and maintenance and number of replacement trees, et cetera, and locate them on site.
So going back to the environmental assessment, the mitigated negative declaration is something that we'll be evaluating as part of our evaluation of this project, correct?
Correct.
So for the benefit of the public, it's really up to this body to determine whether potential hazards have been adequately evaluated and whether they will in fact be mitigated by the measures that are that have been proposed. And I would encourage any members of the public who feel that specific hazards have not been adequately evaluated or will not be mitigated to bring that forward as part of the public comment at that meeting. The performance bond, I think, initially I was thinking not such a big deal, but as you discussed the previous reports and the possibility that there will be hydrocarbons in the soil and the project will be extended, I think we need to put some sort of timeline or some sort of inducement for this not to go on forever. So maybe a performance bond is the way to do it. Maybe there's some other mechanism to ensure that it doesn't continue on. The environmental hygienist, I'm not really sure what that is. They're going to have to give us a little more explanation of that. That's not a term that I commonly run across. So I'm not sure what they're going to have to let us know what the qualifications are and what the educational requirements are for that person. I would agree with Commissioner Ingrassia that it would be much cleaner if that person were selected by the city and answerable to the city rather than to the applicants.
Hey, the notes we've been taking to this point is to add that as a condition.
And the other thing that I would just suggest, I mean, we're not really in a position to sit here tonight and dictate what meeting should be held or what the venue should be. However, speaking for myself personally, the adequacy of the public outreach program will be a significant factor in whether or not we approve this or continue it or deny it. So I just think it behooves the applicants to really communicate with the neighborhood in a meaningful way, because they're gonna be back here on December 6th, and they're gonna need to answer to the neighborhood again.
I know we don't have any plan of record, but I mean, the community can do their own math on the site. If we take away the ESHA that's there, there's a certain amount of square footage on the site, correct? And by right to the zoning that's there, is it capable of becoming single family without a zoning change, or does it have to have a zoning change?
It's zoned right now, R1 planned development with that little ESH area.
So they would have to do a tract map at some point.
Yes.
With whoever would choose to develop the property. But we can use indices that are in the codes now to know that our minimum lot size for a single-family house is X number of square 6, feet.
6,000 square feet,
and
yes.
The site with the esh, you know, net without the esh is a certain square footage. So one can imagine that the proposal at some point could be based on that kind of mathematics. And if it's a planned unit development, it might even be different.
Yeah.
Perhaps even on the higher end than that because of...
There's also some topography to take into account, et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are guessing. So, yes, there you could guess and come up with a range.
Mm-hmm. So do we know what the low end of that is at this point? I mean, we know there's no plan. It's just math. The approximate net square footage.
Well, it's zoned R1, and R1 allows 4 to 7 dwelling units per acre, and there's 10 acres. However, several acres are in esh. Probably at least another acre or two are perhaps too steep, or there may be some geologic or topographic reasons why that wouldn't occur. Anything there is going to have its own internal circulation. There are minimum lot sizes. I appreciate your question, and you know, we can kind of come up with, you know, sort of a range for the December 6th staff report too.
Okay, thanks.
Just one more comment with regard to the traffic. You know, looking at Google Maps, there appears to be a travel way which has been used in the past, which goes parallel to Panorama Drive on the Chevron property to the southern corner of the property, and then around the higher terrain and connects with service roads that go to other Chevron tanks in the area and eventually come out further to the north. I think maybe Little Morrow Creek Road, I'm not sure what, I don't remember offhand which road that connects with. Toro Creek, yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that I want to see the applicants analyze when they come back is, gee, wouldn't it maybe be less impact on the neighborhood and maybe even cheaper for them in the long run to run a bulldozer along that, make a temporary road, and utilize that rather than going through neighborhood streets, particularly when you consider the potential street repairs that they'll be required to make at the end of, or may be required to make at the end of the project. So, I mean, that's an alternative that I think it's to nobody's benefit to be blind to. I mean, obviously, I don't have access to the property. I can't go out there and walk it or drive it, you know. But there are tire tracks that take that route.
There are some, having been on the property, there are some topographic issues that they would have to overcome. Yeah, because getting down to the road, the access road that takes you up there, I mean, it's fairly steep and and it's on the side of a hill that's going through the middle of the Chevron property. But, I mean, you certainly can have mask. I mean, we know the contacts for Chevron, so.
I mean, the tracks seem to go around that hill. They seem to go around the circumference of that hill.
Where do they come up? They come down a pretty steep slope. We had talked previously about this. When I was looking at that, mm-hmm. I had some doubts whether it could, you know, happen or not. But I certainly had the contacts at Chevron that he could talk to, so.
Yeah.
See what their interest is or lack thereof.
But, I mean, let's face it, guys, driving up Buena Vista is not exactly a gentle slope either.
But they're proposing to drive up Buena Vista.
No, I know, but the other streets that they are proposing to, they have quite a slope to them as well, so it might not be that different. Okay, if there are no further comments, do we have a motion?
I move we continue coastal development permit CPO 500, conditional use permit UPO 440 on a time basis to December 6th. Is that good enough?
Yes, thank you.
Second?
I'll second that.
We have a motion and at least one second. all those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Our next public hearing item, our second public hearing item this evening is case number UP0-453, which involves a site location at 2657 Greenwood Avenue, conditional use permit. And I think our other Whitney is going to give us a presentation on this.
Thank you, Chairman Teft, and good evening, commissioners. Oh, wait for it. Thank you kindly. So the next item on the agenda this evening is a request for a conditional use permit approval for a project at 2657 Greenwood to allow an addition exceeding 25% of existing floor area to a non-conforming single-family residence.
Excuse me, could you ladies take your conversation outside, please?
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
Thank you.
The proposed project is located within the R1 S2 single family residential zoning district in the Del Mar neighborhood in North Morro Bay. It's approximately 350 or so odd feet to the east of Spencer's Market. The project requires conditional use permit approval due to the existing non-conforming side yard setback and inadequate interior garage dimensions. All proposed development has been designed to conform with the requirements set forth in the zoning ordinance. This is the existing site as seen from above and from Greenwood Avenue looking towards the southwest. The site plan image on the left shows the proposed second story addition in dark gray, as well as the existing acacia tree that shall remain. You can see the acacia in the center of the landscape plan on the right. This slide shows the existing floor plan. And the proposed first floor plan shows 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and a laundry room. Proposed second floor plan shows the relocated kitchen to the upstairs, a bathroom, a den, a living room, dining room. Note the increased front and side yard setbacks. You can see the roof of the first floor on the sides and in the front. The front and rear elevations. North and south elevations. A 3D rendering of the proposed residence showing its relation to the neighboring homes. And it is staff's recommendation that the Planning Commission approve the requested conditional use permit through the adoption of Planning Commission Resolution 21-16, subject to the associated findings and conditions of approval. Thank you kindly.
Thank you very much. And are there any questions for staff at this time?
I do have one, Joan and Scott. The distance from our homes to the parcels in question, is it 500 or 1,000? What's the distance?
It's 500.
Okay, I'm all right. I'm close.
I checked, you're golden.
I think I'm 750.
So if there are no other questions, oh, I'm sorry.
It's within the zoning requirements. I forget if it encroaches a little bit, but it's definitely within. You're allowed to cantilever out up to 3 feet from the rear property line. I can look specifically at the plans and tell you exactly what that number is.
Didn't we add the condition because it shows 2 feet 11 and the maximum required?
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. They show it on the plans as being 2 feet 11 inches from the rear property line, but it's added as a condition of approval in the resolution that it meets that minimum 3 feet from the rear property line.
Okay.
That's fine.
Other questions? None? Then I'll ask if any members of the commission have ex parte communications to divulge. Seeing none, then this is a public hearing. We will open this up for public comment. Typically, we ask the applicant or applicant's representative to start the ball rolling. So we'd love to hear from you.
Hi, I'm Jed Joyce. I'm the designer and general contractor. I think everything's pretty self-explanatory. We're basically keeping the existing house, the footprint, as is. We're going to redo the inside and basically add on top, so we're not increasing the overall footprint of the existing structure, and basically matching the deck. And the issues of the non-conforming setback are because the house is slightly askew from the property line.
What a surprise.
Yes. So, other than that, if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them. Or
we'll hold our questions until all of public comment, and then if you could hang around, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other members of the public that would like to speak to this proposal? Okay. Seeing none, then we will bring it back to the commission for discussion. Are there any, before we close public comment, are there any questions for the applicant's representative? Jerry.
For the designer, and it's more of a construction detail. We have a lot of problems with these cantilever decks through, you know, rot and water intrusions.
Yeah.
Are you aware of that, and how are you going to detail it so that just in the future it's not going to be a problem?
Definitely with flashing is a major issue, and also using engineered lumber. And we may end up putting some supports on it if we just deem that's more feasible, you know, economically and structurally. But there's just a lot of new products and new ways of doing things. I know we probably all seen the videos of decks falling off or the aftermath. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a real problem. So yeah. That'll just be part of best business practices.
Okay. And then on the detailing of the plans, have you looked at our design guidelines for residential design guidelines? And there doesn't seem to be any detailing for fenestration and doors. Are you?
As far as, I'm not sure what you mean as okay, detailing.
It's basically a, you know, just a clean stucco box. Have you reviewed our city design residential design guidelines?
Yeah, I have. So we tried to definitely make it follow that. And the drift I got is not to make anything too ostentatious as far as, like, you know, the grandiose entries or things like that. I mean, we were going for just a clean prairie school look with stuccoed eaves and nice windows. So not a lot of ornamentation.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Any other questions for the applicant?
I just want to confirm the rendering. I think you took the license of taking the existing tree out. It is intended to leave the existing tree there.
Yeah, that. Yeah. I do all the modeling on SketchUp, and you used to be able to plug it directly into Google Earth, but the newest version, you're not able to do that. So I basically took the Google Earth shot and drew on top of it. Yeah, so
I just wanted to make sure everybody knows.
Yeah, that's why
there's a very
trees.
Large tree there.
Yeah, there's some trees in the front that got pushed into the back.
Have you, your neighbor to the north, okay? I'm just looking, I drove by the place today. And
yeah.
Just taking a look at his view. Have you, I guess I wish I had another picture, you know, from the other side, you know, and in relation to how that's going to be on the other, on the back side, I guess.
Yeah.
In relation to the neighbor's view. Do you, I guess my thing is more of a comment. It'd be nice to have a view from the other side as well, and in relation to where it is to the other neighbors.
Yeah, and I think, is there an overhead shot? Or is that the... Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Part of the issue is the existing house is set back.
You know, it's really set back quite far for your average house. I mean, it'd be hard to find another situation like that in Morro Bay. You know, most have a backyard and et cetera. So we're kind of stuck using the existing structure, you know, for costs and also for environmental reasons and also for planning, you know, if we can keep that existing structure. So there is going to be some impact on the view, but I mean, even if we put the smallest, like a 20 by 20 addition on top, we're still going to be blocking some view.
Yeah. Have you talked to the neighbor though? Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, casually the owner
has
actually talked to quite a few of the people around there. Yeah.
Okay.
So we haven't heard any negative comments so far.
Okay. Thanks.
Just to confirm along the same line, the multifamily development that's just to the west, my recollection is that's combination of one and two story. Is that correct?
Yeah. Is that the one right in front or
the one just
towards the ocean from
right.
from this property?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, those are mixed.
So the two-story elements may already be impacting the view of the neighbors significantly. Pardon? I thought when I was out there today, I saw some that were... I don't know how to rotate this more, but pardon? Yeah, well. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so with that, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the commission for discussion. Who'd like to lead off? Jerry missed the last meeting, so we'll pick on him.
Picking on me again here. I like the project. You know, I like the use of, you know, containing the second floor addition in the existing square foot, you know, footprint. I really don't have a problem with the 4 inches here and there, the half an inch, and these the monuments for the track maps that were set back in the 30s were notorious in this area. You can look at fence lines and they zig and zag depending on where, when the fences were built and who the last surveyor was. So, you know, a couple inches here or there in that neighborhood isn't, you know, is pretty damn good for most of them. I'm just concerned that there isn't a lot of articulation on the facade, especially the front facade. But the only remediating factor of that is the project set so far back, you know, from the street. And with the acacia tree there, it, you know, in the Monterey's, I think those are Monterey shrubs / trees on the frontage, it kind of, most of the project will be blocked. So I guess I'll just bring up to the commission, you know, on where we are on the articulation and the window fenestration, and I don't have a problem with the layout. I just thought there might be some more detail.
Joe?
Well, this is interesting because I'm also undergoing a remodeling, and there was also an issue of 4 inches of a setback on my property, so I'm particularly sensitive to this. In fact, the home probably comes to the commission for what is essentially a trivial reason, that encroachment. But then I started to think about what we've talked about at previous meetings, which was the existing design guidelines and how we might change any existing design guidelines to better suit the community. So I'm getting the feeling, though, that as presently interpreted, this project meets the design guidelines. Is that a fair assumption to make? Okay.
It's the reason that staff's recommending approval of it. It's for the most part it does. And we looked at the house and the proposed design in context with what was over there, and it seemed to match the neighborhood as well. Yeah. And so that's where some of that comes from. It's, you know, they used some of the guidelines. You know, they pushed the second story into the middle of the structure. They did push it away from that one structure whose view would be most blocked. And we did make sure. Point here. We did make sure that we sent notice to them, mm-hmm. so they had the opportunity to comment. When we went out there, it was the first thing I was actually concerned about was, wow, putting that there is going to impact views for the rock and those types of things potentially. And so we did make sure that it was, you know, that they did get the opportunity, mm-hmm. through the postcard. So yeah, and it has the covered front porch as well. So, yeah.
I would try to limit my sometimes unintentional imposition of my taste on somebody else's project. But I too, if it were my home, would probably opt for more detail. But I think I'm unwilling to impose my taste on somebody else. However, I guess we should keep in mind that. If we are going to re-examine the guidelines in an effort to improve them, or make them more explicit, or to improve them, you know, then the notion that, well, every other home in the neighborhood looks like this, and so that should be a satisfying judgment is actually less satisfactory. To be honest, I'm in kind of a muddle here. I'm not quite sure what I'm thinking.
Michael?
Yeah, I agree with Commissioner's comments so far. I think the design guidelines in terms of massing, I think, are really well handled. It steps back. It's got the hipped roof on the top so that, you know, the ridge is minimalized the way the project's developed. And I think that's really great. And the gift that you're allowing the neighbors of this kind of park-like structure that their side yards take advantage of, sorry, with the existing tree, I think is really significant. So it is a restraint that I think is admirable, and the porch, you know, does sort of greet you as you come in. I do think this is absolutely plain. It's the windows with the stucco taken right up to the edge, and I think there's a minimal way to do minimal houses. This is not minimal. This is kind of developer simple. I'm not ready to say it needs to be restudied because I think we have other houses in the neighborhood. This is where I walk my, you know, pets all the time, and I'm familiar with a lot of the homes. There are a lot of homes that show a lot of restraint. And so I don't think it's out of the ordinary at all. And I do like the massing. I do think, though, when we look at the development guidelines, I think especially when you develop stucco homes, where there's no material articulation like you have with siding, typically, that brings in shadow lines, and this would be the kind of thing that, you know, the only easy thing I could say is around the entrance where you've got the stair, maybe bring in one more focus material or some kind of lighting feature in there to make it a little stronger. But I think the massing is really understated, and I think that's admirable. So I'm ready to support it the way it is.
I stopped by the place, and I think the applicant, I agree with the other commissioner. I think the applicant did a pretty good job in trying to go by our current design guidelines. And I would have to kind of agree with what Joe was saying. It's kind of hard to impose a little bit more interest, you know, but to each their own, eh? So that's it.
Yeah, well, I have to echo what Commissioner Lucas said. I think the massing is exceptional. I mean, I think the setback of the second story on the sides, the hipped roof on the sides. I think the front facade is certainly has vertical articulation in terms of the roof line breaking up the, you know. We see so many of these where the second floor is just a straight up continuation of the first floor, and this is not that. I really think the shape of the structure, the mass of it is great. And in terms of ornamentation, I'll be honest with you. I would much rather, this is an honest house, okay? It's built the way it's built, okay? It's designed the way it's designed. I would much rather see this than have, a bunch of stone on the front and styrofoam things around the windows, and then, you know, the plane on the other three sides, which we see so much of. So, you know, this is one of the few houses that really, really fulfills the design guideline that the finishes need to be the same on all four sides of the house. And I'm okay with that. There are certain neighborhoods where I think this wouldn't work because of the material. There are certain neighborhoods where this stucco would stick out like a sore thumb. However, it's neighborhood compatibility, and this is a fairly, this is not an unusual material in this particular neighborhood. So, and I agree. I think the 4 inches here and the 4 inches there probably have to do with surveying competency over the years. So I don't really have a problem with this.
This was a dilemma for me, and I concur. You know, I don't want to see ornamentation just for ornamentation, but it's also, you know, I think the saving grace on this is this house is set back into the lot, and, you know, I see the front setback as a gift to the neighborhood, and would like to see that maintained, you know, in any future projects on this house, but... So I'll concur. I wanted to throw that out there and see where the rest of the commissioners were on this. This house, you know, set back 20 feet from the front property line, I don't think I could agree to. But where it is and how it's handled, I can, it'll fit. But, so I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, and I also appreciate the fact that it's not derivative. You know, it's not trying to be Tuscany. It's not trying, whatever Tuscany is, I have no idea. But you know, it's designed to be what it is. You know, and that's to me that's refreshing. Are we ready for a motion? UPO 453.
UPO 453. I'll make a motion to approve resolution PC 2114, conditional use permit UPO 453 for project at 2657 Greenwood Avenue.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on the motion? Could we have a roll call on this, please?
Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Sadowski?
Aye.
Commissioner Luhr?
Yes.
Commissioner Ingraffia?
Aye.
And Chairman Teft?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
And I would just like to point out that all these guys up here have their iPads, and it's the guy with the paper that came up with the project number. Okay, we have no new business nor unfinished business tonight, so we will move ahead to Planning Commissioner comments.
The only comment I really have is that, you know, the San Salvador is still in port, and I think it's of value for people to view it, and, you know, it can be viewed from the dock and via, you know, it's worthwhile to see. It's a technological marvel of its day.
Earlier we discussed maybe a future agenda item. Is this the time right now?
Yes.
I would like to maybe make a future agenda item just for discussion, Scott, you know, on the flag height and mainly the UHF and the VHF. You know what I'm saying.
Sure, yeah. Certainly. I mean, yeah. I can at least give you the. I'll agendize it for. I'm not going to do a whole bunch of work on it. I'll give you the ordinance,
yeah.
And that can help lead the discussion. I mean, I've talked several times about it, and I've had lots of conversations with Mr. Krause, and I understand the issues that he's having over there, and our ordinance, mm-hmm. you would think, would be able to do something about it, but it sort of has a hole in it when you're looking at this section of it. So anyway, yeah, I'm happy to agendize it, and we can talk about it a little bit, and you know, maybe funnel. You know, changes into the general plan LCP update. You know, zoning code.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, this kind of hinges too on the whole private view protection and stuff too. So that's a slippery slope to get into.
I think it is one of those things that's got some discretion. I mean, in fact, we have ordinances about the shape of the building envelope and then what is allowed beyond the shape of the building envelope. And those are very selected things. And I know in the right-of-way, we've asked people to take down things. My neighbor had a flagpole that actually nobody, didn't bother anybody I knew, that the city asked to take down because it was in the right-of-way. That's my understanding, but that's the different issue.
Just recently?
Yeah.
There was a gentleman who came around town and probably gave us, what would you say, boss, 20 or so complaints about flagpoles around the city.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. So I'm just saying, when we have teeth, we're exercising it. If we need to give Scott some dentures, we'll.
Excellent.
Well, the question I had, Scott, was what would apply if what regulation would apply if this were not an antenna, if it were just a let's say I just decided to erect a windmill or something in my backyard.
How about just what we were talking about, a flagpole? The only thing that applies is the height in the zone and our setback requirements to some extent. So.
But do we have any regulations that pertain to, like, other structures? In other words, if I wanted to go out and just build, like, a kind of erector-set tower in my backyard,
So that's the thing, you know. I mean, it's kind of, you know, the city has not interpreted these types of things, flagpoles, just antennas on a pole, to be structures. Usually structures have been interpreted to be something more substantial. So as you're getting into things like sheds and sometimes play equipment, depending on how large it is, but we haven't regulated a lot of those things much. I mean, you can have the 80 square feet of whatever, and you can put it any place you want on your lot. Put it up against a fence in the corner. And those have been treated as temporary type things. One of the things we hope to get out of the zoning code update is sort of defining some of these a little bit more, because we don't have these items in our code. There's not a laundry list of them, and many codes have them. Many updated codes have things like this, and so you go through and you're like, oh, yep, we have a code for that, and it tells you what you can do with them. It either says, yeah, that's fine, or no, it's not, or yeah, you have to come in and get a site plan review and approval, those types of things. And those are also things that we're looking to put into the code. Is right now you can do it. Some additions and even single family homes can go through without any sort of staff level review or planning commission review. If it's all compliant, just goes. We'd like to have a site plan review, so at least we're paying attention to, you know, compliance with design guidelines and what have you.
I mean, short of looking at these things, you know, with our proliferation of these small cell towers, somebody could lease their backyard to a cell tower company, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, it becomes an issue, yeah. I mean, the city's always treated any type of cell tower issue as something that requires a permit. But I'm just sort of going off of the history, you know. I mean, we don't have a history of flagpoles and similar type structures of regulating those.
I would suggest with these discussions that we really have to try and bifurcate antennas and flagpoles, because quite aside from the patriotic values loaded onto flags and flagpoles, it's pretty clear that the display of a flag is speech.
No, absolutely. That's absolutely. Chair Tuff, and I have been working through our sign ordinance, and this has been sort of upfront.
The notion of being able to subject or sublimate, if you will, the display of the flag to someone else's view might be a really difficult argument.
You can have time, place, and manner restrictions on speech. I mean, in fact, you know, the U.S., the federal code has a fairly extensive section on how what you should and shouldn't do when displaying the flag.
But it all boils down to essentially, we want to support your freedom of speech unless it unreasonably infringes on somebody else's. That's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah, I think that what you hit on is like for a sign, I was just thinking when you said it, is if you put a flag up there and say you're running for office, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Is it a sign? You know.
Well, but aside from that, I mean, there are structurally, a 100-foot flagpole requires a good deal more foundation than a 20-foot flagpole.
You know? I mean, that would require a building permit. Because you get into wind loading and things like that. I mean, so, yeah.
Scott, there was also the application of windmills to down into buildings and residences. I know we had a spate of windmills that were applied to buildings in town, and I think there was an ordinance, or there was a...
Oh.
That was...
All I can say is I'm not familiar with it. It's not something that's come up in my tenure here.
Okay.
Well, something that I've come across. I don't recall reading anything about it either. So,
yeah.
Not to say it's not there. I find all kinds of interesting things on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But you know, in that, you know, for antennas and stuff that can almost be deemed an antenna, when you go to the vertical axis windmills, which are being developed now. So as far as alternative power, you know, there's some interesting applications that would be precluded by these, you know, interpretations too.
Why we'll agendize it for further discussion and probably end the discussion now. I think we're probably beyond it at this point.
I wanted to say something too. You know that class that you offered us to go to?
The Planning Academy?
The Planning Academy. I went to the first. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Scott, I appreciate you giving that offer up to us, and I noticed a couple of other staff people there, and it was, I'm looking forward to getting educated better.
I'm glad it was worthwhile. I mean, it seemed worthwhile, and it was, I was actually, it was unfortunate that I couldn't participate in it. I was going to be one of the presenters at one point, and kind of came into a conflict with plans that I had. I wasn't able to do it, so. But I was happy to be able to offer it up to all of you and the General Plan Advisory Committee as well, and I think it's worthwhile, and there's a lot of interesting topics that they're going to discuss and talk to you about, and you get some good discussions out of that, and I think it's definitely worthwhile for anybody that sits on, you know, boards like yourself. So.
I apologize profusely to the lady for missing the first meeting to pick up my
With that, we'll move on to Community Development Director comments.
I don't have any comments. Well, we do have the upcoming general plan workshop for the Downtown Waterfront Strategic Plan on the, was it the 12th?
12th.
From 6 to 8:30 in this building, that's all. So beyond that, that's about all I have.
With that, then, we will adjourn to our next regular meeting, which will be here at the Vets Hall on October 18th at 6 p.m. Thank you very much.